Does anyone need a copy of the handout about project ideas or homework? So what I want to do today is start with, for a few minutes at least, discuss project ideas. And then I'll talk about Galois representations and R-null functions. And then I'll give you an overview lecture about elliptic curves over Q. And then I'll start in more detail on elliptic curves in general. Actually, you can view this more as the plan for the rest of the course, but I'll start here today, see how far we get. Okay, so first, does anybody have any idea what they want to do their project on? Yes, Stephen?
From SLS theorem for regular prime exponents.
But there's a typo in...
It's regular or...
Yeah,
well,
it's...
So I assume
defined it correctly.
Regular ones,
well,
first.
Yeah. Regular is the one you do, irregular... So,
okay.
Yeah, regular, just delete the IR from that. The definition is correct, but it's not of irregular, it's of regular. So irregular means P does divide the class group, the order of the class group. So prove Fermat for that case. Sure, sounds good. So I think there's a funny open problem there, which is that we don't know whether or not there are infinitely many regular primes.
You do know that there are infinitely many regular primes.
I don't think you know that there are infinitely many in either.
Somebody that, like when Coomer proved the famous theorem for regular primes, during the proof that there are irregular primes, so that the proof is very
close.
That should be. They're definitely expected to be infinitely many regular primes, but we don't know for sure. I'm not sure whether it's a theorem that there are infinitely many irregular primes. I'm just not sure. I'm sure there's probably a theorem if you assume some hypothesis. Are you sure that it's a theorem without any
conjectures? It's flavored like a joke because like there's a competition going on between Dirichlet and Coomer in Fermat's Fermat's theorem.
Okay.
They both lost.
Anyways, you should resolve this point in your project.
Alright. I could try to resolve the point for Dobin, but...
Try to resolve.
I can stay today. Sorry.
See you later. Have a good day. Come back soon. So I think there... Don't be confused because he's going the wrong way.
Are we taking this?
Sure, go ahead. Actually, take four. Please. I don't know. I was under the impression that without assuming any conjectures, you only knew that there are infinitely many of one or the other, but you couldn't prove it. So, I don't know. I mean, it's obvious there are infinitely many of one or the other because there are infinitely many primes. But I could be wrong. This isn't exactly my area of research. So, you have a good idea for a project.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
And I'd also like to work on Sage, but next year for an MIT project. But
okay,
that,
you'll have to do it
class.
From the FARD, but... you'd have to do it from afar because I'm moving, but
it's
good to work over the internet.
Yeah.
Okay,
other
ideas for projects.
How much reading is required for data functions? How much reading?
What do you know about complex? Do you know any complex analysis? Have you ever taken complex analysis?
I have.
Okay, so you've taken like calculus. And real analysis? Real analysis, okay. Depends how far you want to go. I mean, if you just want to say define the zeta function attached to a number field and then prove something about its analytic properties, then you know it's a certain amount of reading. If you want to prove the analytic class number formula, that's a huge amount of reading. So I think you can do a project on that even if you don't know anything so far. But you'll just read an appropriate amount given the amount of time you have and then write up to that point. I think that would be reasonable. Make sure you have some clean goals such as, for example, proving at least the analytic properties of the Riemann zeta function, that it has an analytic continuation to the whole complex plane except for a simple pole at s equal to 1. At least something like that along those lines. So some sort of clean pole. But you don't have to prove, you don't have to like figure out what the residue is at s equal to 1 or prove the analytic class number. That's kind of a big thing to do. By the way, there are three handouts. Did you get three? In a tricky way, there are actually three handouts. And I think the third one is buried at the bottom here. So did you get this? This is the introduction page to your course assistance. Yeah, it says introduction at the top.
Oh, I didn't get that.
There's three total things.
No, I didn't get that.
So I can just mess around.
Yeah. So this is this page that says introduction is actually the introduction to Andre George's senior thesis that he just handed in. And he told me that he was a little embarrassed by it because he wrote it in a half hour on the morning before he turned in his thesis. But actually, I think it's pretty good, and it really does give a sense of what we're going to do in the last piece of the course, which is explain something about arithmetic of elliptic curves and an analogy between arithmetic of elliptic curves and arithmetic of number fields. Okay, so that's... Yes?
The first one, the project. I'll get a project would number three, the analytic class number formula, be for given a course in, or given courses in both complex analysis and analytic number theory?
Great. Yeah, if you've already had those in your project, you assume that the reader has had such courses, then I think you could reasonably write up a proof. You could do a special case, I suppose, if it got to be too big. But I think if you assume appropriate background on the part of the reader and yourself, then that's completely reasonable. Yeah. Do you want to do that? Or I mean, you're not committing,
I mean,
but...
Yeah. Well, I won't commit.
Okay.
But
yes?
I was told that the quadratic forms in ideal classes is a big part of the Disquisitiones and
mm-hmm.
like 19th
that's true.
Century.
Yeah, it's huge.
So what exactly, I guess, could you flesh out what an appropriate angle approaching that would be? Like,
well, first there is one project you can read from last year that was on this.
Okay.
So you could look at that. You could take a different, you could take kind of a computational point of view, which is the following. Suppose you have a quadratic extension of Q, and you want to compute its class group. You want to give an algorithm to compute the class group. One of the best ways to do that is to translate the question of computing the class group into a question about computing with quadratic forms. So then you could motivate the whole discussion as a discussion about how can we compute explicitly class groups of quadratic fields, and then translate that into and use it to motivate quadratic forms and composition laws and quadratic forms and so on, and then talk about that. That would be one approach that one could take. But if you don't like computation or algorithms so much, then you don't have to take that approach. There's another different approach you could take, which would be to look at the work of Manjul Bhargava, which is pretty recent, where he generalizes the Gauss composition law for binary quadratic forms to higher degree forms. And he's been able to prove some interesting density statements about number fields using these generalizations. So you could look at his thesis and some of his papers and try to get your head around some of it. He also has a much better conceptual description of Gauss's original composition law, which is kind of amazing that he came up with a better way to think about it after all these years. So, and I think he just won some big prize for his research on composition laws, so that would be a different approach that you could take. So one or the other or both, but it's very beautiful and has a long, long tradition, these composition laws. And it's really kind of non-trivial. I mean, it's pretty subtle going from an ideal to a quadratic form and back again. It's surprisingly subtle. And here with ideals, there's a pretty natural way to multiply two ideals. And then when you can pass to the class group and you get multiplication in the class group. And that's really not so mysterious. Multiplying quadratic forms, though, I mean, or composing quadratic forms, it's if you define a bijection here that that works correctly when you pass to equivalence classes, and you have an appropriate notion of equivalence down here, the thing that corresponds to just multiplication of ideals turns out to be really complicated down here, at least if you write it down in terms of formulas. Though there is, again, this conceptual way of thinking about it that Manjul found, which basically involves considering a 2x2 Rubik's Cube. Sort of amusing. So certainly you could do a great project about quadratic forms. And there are a couple of directions you could go in. So
five, the analog for function fields of finite fields.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds interesting to me, but I don't know anything about algebraic curves.
Uh-huh.
So
you have to learn something.
What sort of stuff would I have to learn then?
Well, first you can remember we proved that OK is a Dedekind domain. Which was a statement about being integrally closed in its field of fractions, having dimension one, and so on. So one thing you would do, the first thing you might do would be to prove that, first you might prove that FP adjoined T is a Dedekind domain. The proof is very similar, though a little bit different. And you might then more generally prove that the field of functions on a rational curve, the field of rational functions on a curve over a finite field is a Dedekind domain. So here you have to learn what that means. What does it mean to, when I say field, inside of the field of rational functions, there's an analog of the ring of integers. And you can prove that this is a Dedekind domain. And then you can just try to systematically develop the theory similar to what we did and look at each step of how things are different when you work over, when you replace a number field by a field of functions on an algebraic curve. So what you'd want to do first, I think, is just sit down and read a few chapters out of a book on algebraic curves. And there are many, many good books on algebraic curves. I think there's a nice one by Fulton. But there are many, many such books. And you just want to sit down and read through that. And then, not the whole book, but just a few chapters. And then you would go back and look at what we've done in the course and see how much carries over in this other context. Okay, and I think it would be a great project to do also. Because there's one thing that's different, which is the class group just doesn't turn up. The analog of the class group, if you define it exactly in the same way as we defined it for number fields, it isn't finite. There's some big free abelian part, and then there's a finite subgroup, or possibly infinite subgroup. It's just that that's one thing that turns out to be a lot different. But given that you told me you read a lot of the background for this course when you were in high school, and you seem to have no problem at all at this course, I think you would have no problem reading background on algebraic curves or something.
Okay.
And it'd be a lot of fun. Who else has any ideas about their projects? Questions about possibilities for projects? I mean, you're not committing to anything right now.
How about chronic curve every step?
Let's see. It's a cool theorem. It's really neat. You know exactly what the abelian extensions of Q are. So it tells you exactly what the abelian extensions of the rational numbers are. So class field theory tells you what the abelian extensions of any number field are. And this is a special case. Yeah. So if you have an abelian extension, K of Q, and a finite extension with the abelian Galois group, Kronecker-Weber says it's contained in Q zeta n for some n. So,
and it's a special case of class theory.
Yes. It's a special case of it is class field theory for the field Q. You have class field theory for each number field. Class field theory classifies the abelian extensions of any fixed number field in terms of arithmetic of the field itself. And Kronecker-Weber, it tells you that every abelian extension is contained in a field Q zeta n. These fields Q zeta n are abelian extensions, so you've really classified the abelian extensions of Q. If anyone says, consider an abelian extension of Q, the first thing you might ask is, okay, which Q zeta n is it contained in? And then, this extension has Galois group Z mod n Z star. So this K corresponds to a subgroup of Z mod n Z star via Galois theory. So Kronecker-Weber tells you that to give an abelian extension of Q is exactly the same as giving an n and a subgroup of this group, which is pretty amazing. And it can be a little bit tricky to go from, or at least not at all obvious, how to go from, not completely obvious to me at least, how to go from giving an n and a subgroup of this to the actual k. In fact, I posted a challenge problem on my website for this course, which was the following. So remember we proved you had an exercise
So first we proved that if you have any ideal of a full ring of integers, then it's generated by at most two elements. Then there was a very tricky exercise, which was if you consider an ideal of an order, is it generated by two elements? Always. So do you remember what the answer to that was?
No.
It could have a lot of generators. So a natural question then arises. So remember that if you have a ring of integers in a number field, okay, sometimes it's equal to Z adjoined, sometimes it's generated by one element. But sometimes it cannot be generated by one element. We have this example of an essential discriminant divisor. So there was this example of Dedekind where there was always an index of at least two that divided Z adjoined A. The index of Z adjoined A in OK was always divisible by two, no matter how you chose A. However, you could throw in another B in that particular example, at least, I think, and you get that OK is Z adjoined A and B for two things. So another question is the ring of integers of a number field always generated as a ring by two elements? So it turns out the answer to that is no, as someone who was here last year told me, but he wasn't here this year for some reason. But he keeps answering all the challenge problems that are interesting here. But you can ask, you have this, and the answer is not in general. And he gave a recipe for constructing counterexamples. The idea is simply to make a field of large degree with the property that 2 splits completely into a whole bunch of primes. Then what happens is that OK modulo 2, by the Chinese remainder theorem, is the direct sum of a bunch of copies of FP. F2. F2 plus F2, a whole bunch of times. And imagine that OK were Z adjoined AB, were generated by two things. Then modulo 2, it would be F2 adjoined A and B, modulo sum relations. So if OK is Z adjoined AB, then OK mod 2 would be F2 adjoined two things, or adjoined two indeterminate modulo relations. Now, there aren't very many homomorphisms from F2 adjoined two things to F2. In fact, such a homomorphism is completely determined by where you send A and B. So there are only 4 possibilities for such a homomorphism. However, if 2 splits completely, you can easily make it so that there are far more than just 2 homomorphisms from this direct sum to F2. So what he did was he explained a way to construct examples where 2 splits completely. And one example he constructed, I worked it out, and I think you take n equal to the prime 151, and then here this is the unique degree 5 subfield of that Q zeta. And once I knew that, it still wasn't clear what an equation for K is. I wanted an equation so I could explicitly verify that really 2 does split completely. However, I just looked in a table that has all number fields of given degree unramified outside of certain primes, and I found that there was, I think there were 2 of degree 5 unramified outside of 151, and one of them was this one. It had to be. So, I actually don't know exactly how to, complete generality, how do you explicitly construct the field corresponding to subgroup of this? Probably in the literature, probably not that hard, but I just want to throw out a nice question for you.
Wait, does Paris Paul sub 6 cyclo do that or not? Paul sub cyclo. I thought it was just that. I'm not sure what constraints are on it.
Though. Cyclo.
Like,
probably. That sounds good. How does it work?
I'm not sure.
Okay. There's a question.
It also has some constraints on, I think, on what on what Z mod N Z cross has to be.
So, I didn't look at all. I just looked at a table really quickly. I didn't look in the literature at all about how to solve this problem. And I don't want a solution that's really, really bad, like compute this field and then use Galois theory, because this field's massive and you don't want to really compute in it.
If you don't insist on prime 2, can you not find like simpler fields? Because it's just a matter of number of copies that you have, right?
Yeah, it's just, but there's a trade-off.
Then you have you have joined with A, B, and then
you have more. See, it's 2 to the n here, where n is number generated, so it would be p to the n.
Yes.
So you have to be careful. There's a little trade-off there. You have a comment, please.
I don't see why you can't just figure out what the degree index 5 subgroup of Z mod NZ star
sure,
is.
Sure, you can do that,
join,
no problem.
Adjoin those powers of zeta.
Ah, that sounds okay. Let's see. Okay, so first you have this field generated by zeta. We don't actually explicitly compute it. We just imagine we have our zeta n. Then in the cyclic case, at least, which was the case we're considering, we have a subgroup of this H, which I'll just do the cyclic case, which implicitly is generated by some element A. So you're suggesting just take zeta n to the power of A. So here this group should have index right here. This H is the Galois group of this. So zeta n to the... You need the fixed... You need things that are fixed by that. So how do you do that? You need the fixed field of H. Did I mess up somehow? So this should have, in my example, this would have index 5.
Or maybe pick the one with index...
Well, that's just a cyclic group of order 30, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. But...
Maybe pick the H with size 5.
Okay, so we could instead take an H with size 5. Okay, so now I'm instead defining the cardinality H to be something of cardinality 5. So you're suggesting take zeta n to the power of A, and you think this will generate K?
1 minute?
I don't know, maybe.
Is that going to generate the whole field? Because you can just, A is invertible, so you, or blah.
A is invertible modulo n, that's true. So you could just take zeta n to the power of A to the power of the inverse of A, which is B, and then you get zeta n again. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if one person in this room could easily, if you sat down and thought about this question carefully, solve this problem. Somebody should. I'm not even going to try, so that one of you. I'll just pose exactly this problem. I mean, part of one solution would be to read the figure out how Paul subcyclo works if there really is such a command, which you said there is. So, but knowing there's a command and actually knowing what it does.
Actually, maybe you want to take the sum of the orbit. On
that
the
makes good sense.
Yeah,
to that's okay. Zeta, and then you have to find the minimal polynomial. Zeta n to the a for.
For a using h.
Zeta n to the, I don't know, alpha for alpha in h.
Might work.
Seems like a good idea, because, for example, to find the index 2 subfield, you just take zeta n plus zeta n inverse, and that is the orbit under the group of order 2. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if you can show that works. Seems sensible. Because this is something that would be fixed under every element of H. Hey, that's got to work. So, because it's fixed under every element of H, you've taken the orbit and summed up.
You could generate a too small a field.
That's true.
So it doesn't necessarily work.
You're right. Well, you have to check something. It would be in the field. It would be in the field. You still have to check that it's big enough.
Okay, and you could also replace H with any coset of H in the group, and that would still work.
Mm-hmm.
And that might give you additional stuff.
Oh, so maybe you have to throw in all the cosets. Except what? Well, yeah. Maybe you have to throw in the cosets.
Huh. How can you get
it's
a field?
An abelian group.
How can you get a field that's too small though? If it's a subfield of K, then it has to be either K or Q, right? Because
it's
five is prime.
Oh, but this is just a specific example. We could consider the more general case. You're definitely right about this particular example. Right, it could be any smaller. But more generally, you might want to do it. You might want to figure out what Paul subcyclo is doing. And also, you have to find the. You have to find the minimal polynomial of this, and that might be sort of hard. What if n is very large? You could take n to be. Just to ask the question and make it more difficult, you could say n is a five-digit prime, and you still want a degree 5 subfield.
So
I don't know if that's really, really hard or not.
Do you just not need to find the number of elements in the orbit of that orbit, right?
The number?
Under Galois group. Because it's minimal polynomial, is its orbit under the Galois group, right? I mean, the roots of its minimal polynomial.
Yeah.
and then you can make an argument like, you know, the you know the minimum polynomial of say 10, so
mm-hmm.
like the two things are very unlikely to be equal, but I don't, it's not a complete argument.
Okay. Another trick you might do is just use zeta n as e to the 2 pi I over n as a floating point, you know, complex number to some precision. Then you can do this, you can compute this as an exact, sorry, as an approximate complex number. Then you can do a similar computation and get each of the conjugates of this and then make the polynomial out of them. And you'll get, you know, x minus the product of each conjugate, where you do all the computations using floating point numbers. But when you multiply everything out, you get a polynomial with integer entries, and then you can recognize them. And if you've done your computation to sufficient precision, you might be okay. You're starting out. So if you do Kronecker Weber, it'd be a good thing to adjust this, or to adjust it anyways. But I'm not going to come to a conclusion about this unless somebody thinks of something before the end of class. Okay, other ideas for projects or comments? Yes?
Oh, I just have a question about these. It seems like there aren't very many things to do about elliptic curves. Is that because there's not much we can do by the time we have to start this project, or are there just not interesting problems? Or?
Well, there's tons of interesting problems. Mainly the... I guess it's mainly that I'm not sure what I'm going to do with elliptic curves, and I don't know how much you know, so I kind of wrote this somewhat assuming that you only knew what you'd seen in the class so far, to some extent, and you haven't seen elliptic curves in here so far, but you should not feel constrained to do one of these 11 projects, especially given that there are more than 11 people who are in the class. Do you have an idea for an elliptic curves project?
No, that's why I'm asking.
Well, let's see. So elliptic curve projects, natural ones do something related to cryptography, for example, if you're interested in that at all. Like, let's just elliptic curve factorization method is really fun to look at. And, you know, also making elliptic curves cryptosystems can be something you could learn about and write up something about. They're extremely good to use in practice. They're probably the best cryptosystems by far. So there's the crypto angle, then... So one thing is, I think so far in this class, I don't know if you'll agree, but I think I've been extremely systematic and really not left a lot of gaping holes in the presentation. That's going to completely change with elliptic curves. We're going to just have fun. There are going to be many holes in the presentation when we do elliptic curves. I'm going to state some things for algebraic geometry. You're just going to have to accept them on faith. Every time I do that, that's an opportunity for a project. So... there'll be many, many opportunities that you'll see there in like the next week even. So I hope that's okay with everyone. I'm not going to systematic, but we'd get nowhere at all if I did that, if I systematically did every little detail with elliptic curves. Okay, other thoughts or comments or ideas about projects? Yes?
How much harder would it be to try to do something like Chebotarov instead of just Dirichlet?
Well, let's see.
Like, I mean, you need like class field theory-ish things.
Yeah, it's definitely possible. You just have to assume more background on the part of the reader of your project. There was one project last year on Chebotarov by Jen Balakrishnan, I think. She didn't prove it. She just talked about it and explained what it said, basically, and gave examples and applications of it. And that's something you could do. For example, you could, you know, say, here's something surprising that you observe if you look at how polynomials factor modulo different primes. You know, why is it that if you write down a polynomial and then look how it factors mod many different primes, why do you see these really nice patterns in the splitting behavior of your polynomial? And then Chebotarov totally explains why you do. So instead of trying to write a proof of Chebotarov, you could explain what it says. You could use it to show, you can get the Dirichlet theorem on primes in arithmetic progression as an easy application of Chebotarov. It says things about quadratic residues, so you could state the theorem, which is actually pretty simple to state. I mean, I'll tell you what it says, like some of you don't know. It says that if you take a Galois extension K over Q, I suppose some of you do know from Frank's lecture, but if you take a Galois extension with group G, and you can wonder how often when you take
a prime p here. If you have a prime p here, you get a conjugacy class of Frobenii, Frobenius elements, Frob p, in the Galois group. So remember before, last time I defined how you get a Frobenius element at a prime line over p in the ring of integers of k. You have that exact sequence, you take an element of the Galois group of the finite field, and it lists uniquely as long as the prime's unramified. And if you take a prime down here, you don't get a unique Frobenius element, but you get a conjugacy class, and that's what the square bracket means, conjugacy class. The notation's maybe a little funny. I could put prob p, a little Gothic p here, but since I'm putting square brackets, it doesn't matter which Gothic p you choose. So you get a conjugacy class of Frobenius. And the Chebotov density theorem tells you what the density of primes p are that give you a given conjugacy class. If you fix a conjugacy class in the group G, then H is a conjugacy class in G, then the density theorem tells you that the density, this is the Dirichlet density of P such that the class of Frob P equals H, this is equal to the cardinality of the conjugacy class divided by the cardinality of the group. So that's what it says, and this has applications in many, many things. So I think probably the best project in here would be to think about things we've done so far in the course and things that are interesting to you, and then see how Chebotov connects to them. But you could try to give some part of the proof if you wanted, assuming many things, or maybe the whole proof, assuming a lot of things. That would be pretty ambitious. But I wouldn't dissuade you. You, actually.
Yeah. I was curious about Gross's paper about the Kolbami theorem. Would that be a...
Mm-hmm. So one thing we're going to do very soon is Galois cohomology. And this is a paper that uses a bunch of Galois cohomology, and it's by our famous dean. So yeah, I think that you could read through that paper and then try to write your own exposition of the key points. I think that would be reasonable. And you'll have to write something up about complex multiplication points on modular curves. So yeah, I certainly like that as a potential project. Certainly. Gary.
Yeah, I didn't have a question about the topic. I was just wondering in general, how ambitious should we be for these projects? Like what should we aim to prove? How much should we aim to cover? Like it sounds like, for example, this project, it's beyond your expectations for anyone to prove, like Chebotov's theorem, for example. So what sort
that
of...
That is a little beyond my... It's pretty hard. I think that... are you asking this from the point of view of what grade you'll get, or...?
No, I'm asking from the point of view of how in-depth should our projects be.
I think you should just think of it this way. Your project, after it's done, is going to go on the webpage for the course. Imagine other people who are like say following the course from afar and want to read something that is somehow related to the course but interesting. And that's what you should aim at. So it's not so much, you know, how in depth do you want to make it, but how interesting could you make it to your classmates? Try to write something that everyone else in this class is going to want to look at and will get something out of. Okay. So just like think, what would Allison enjoy reading if she were to sit down, you know, for an hour and read your project, for example? Sorry to single you out, but I think that's what you should aim at. Think of your audience not as me, but your fellow classmates who want to maybe work hard to read something, but something they'll enjoy reading.
Well, what's the, the length expectations?
I don't have any length expectations, actually. Better be longer than one page, though. Well, it could be one page if it were a really exciting page.
A really clever book or something new.
Yeah, it could be just a margin, I don't know. Or it could be a very, very tiny typeface, I don't know. And I mean, even if you wanted to prove something new, that's, of course, you could try that too. Okay, so any other comments or questions about projects? Okay, again, the official due date is May 18th,
If that date's horrible for you, just turn it in a little earlier. What's next?
This is Galois representations.
Alright, so take one deep breath. All the careful rigor that we've been developing through this course will now be relaxed somewhat. I'm not going to try to justify every statement, hence for the rest of the semester, like I've, I think, tried very hard to do so far. But that means you should still feel free to ask any questions about what you saw. Should stop doing that. Okay, so I'm starting with section 10.5, and remember last time I defined a Galois representation to be a continuous homomorphism from the Galois group of Q bar over Q, which I will henceforth denote by G sub Q, to GLN of C. And you also have Galois representations for number fields. That would be a homomorphism from G sub K, just Galois K bar over K, to GLN of C. And we want this to be continuous. And the meaning of continuous, again, it's more than just having finite image. It's that it has finite image and that the map factors through a finite Galois extension. Definition of a Galois representation. A Galois representation. There are actually other types of Galois representations. You can replace C by the field of p-adic numbers and get p-adic Galois representations, for example. Or you can replace C by a finite field and you get modular, well, mod p representations. So Artin associated an L function to any Galois representation. Which I'll denote by L rho S. And now I'm going to define L rho S and state again the main conjecture about it and tell you something about what's known about L rho S. So this is a function from the complex numbers to the complex numbers union infinity. More precisely, if you know about complex analysis, it's meromorphic. It's the way I'll define it, it will only make it clear that it's defined on a right half plane, so for a real part of S sufficiently large. But it is a theorem of Artin from the 30s that it can be meromorphically continued to the whole complex plane. Meromorphic means that you have isolated poles and they're not too bad. You can multiply by meromorphic at zero means you can multiply by some power of S so that it becomes holomorphic. That distinguishes it from an essential singularity where it would no power of S times the thing would be holomorphic. But holomorphic means it's a complex version of analytic. It's a very strong constraint to put on a complex function. Okay, so now how do you define L rho S? So what you do is you take what we did last time. So here we have a finite Galois extension, K over Q, and I'm going to define L rho S as a product over every prime P of a local factor, which I'll denote by LP rho S. So this is an infinite product of functions, which, and that's something that can be made precise. So I've now reduced the question to defining a function, one for each prime number p. So let's fix a prime number p. This prime may or may not be ramified, and there's some subtlety in the definition when it's ramified, but I'll actually explain how to correctly deal with that subtlety. So p is a prime of z, and may or may not ramify up here. And up here we have the conjugacy class of broad p, which isn't really just only well-defined modulo inertia groups at primes line over p at this point. So just to make sure that's completely clear, if you fix a specific decomposition group, then you have inside of it the inertia group, and then you have the Galois group of an extension of finite fields. We prove that surjective, and you can lift the frob here to a choice well-defined modulo the inertia group of a Frobenius frob P1, say. And you can do that with the other PIs, where the PIs are exactly the prime line over P. So okay, now we have this representation rho that is a way to make the Galois group act on an n-dimensional complex vector space. These n's are different, so I'll change this to a g. So you can view this, instead of viewing it as gln of c, view it as ot v, where v is an n-dimensional complex vector space. And that way we can, now you can just view v as a module over g, over the group g. So it makes sense to write things like, if you have an element of the Galois group, and you can, and an element v in this finite dimensional complex vector space, you can write sigma dot v, by which I mean rho of sigma of v. So it's just a module. So if you have any of you been in a representation theory course or seen group representation theory? So a lot of you have, that's good. So this is really just, in some sense, a special case of that, but where you maybe you hope you've only done it in the case of finite groups, but you could do it for infinite groups also. So this is a group representation. And, well, if you take V, this vector space, then there's a certain subspace of it on which you have a well-defined action of frob P1. So here's the subspace you take. So take the subspace of elements that are fixed under the inertia group at P1. So this is the element V in V such that sigma V equals V for all sigma in the inertia group. And so you don't get too worried. If for all but finitely many primes, this is just equal to the full V. There's just finitely many primes where this need not be equal to the full V. And the only reason I'm introducing this is because I want to really give you the true definition of the L function, not just the L function with finitely many primes removed. So this is the module of V that's fixed by the inertia group. And then the decomposition group, which acts on V by virtue of it being a subgroup of the Galois group, the decomposition group also acts on this. So let's see, we have to justify that. It's because the inertia group is a normal subgroup of the decomposition group. So you get a well-defined action of the fixed stuff for the inertia group on here. And the reason it's a normal subgroup is because it's the kernel of a homomorphism. So the decomposition group acts on the fixed submodule of our Galois representation for the inertia group, the inertia invariance. And moreover, the inertia group acts trivially on here, because after all, it's exactly the subspace in which the inertia group acts trivially. So inertia acts trivially on here. And why am I doing this? Well, if you take any choice of frog P1, this is well-defined modulo the inertia group, its action on this is totally well-defined because it only depended on the choice of inertia. It only depended on adding some element of the inertia group, but the inertia group acts trivially on here. So you get a well-defined action of frog P1 on here. And you could do this with P2, P3, etc. And in each case, you get a well-defined action of frog on here. You might get slightly different modules, whatever, but you'll get the same characteristic polynomials. If you choose any pi lying over p, the characteristic polynomial of frog pi acting on this won't change, because you're changing the frogs just by conjugation. So the actual characteristic polynomials don't change. So what we get is an association p to a polynomial, which I don't know what letter I used to denote it in my notes.
Question?
Yes?
Is it obvious that frogs differ by a conjugation factor?
It's not too hard to prove, and it's proved as proposition 10.4.1 on the previous page in one sentence. And I admit that I omitted that, but we can do it since it's only one sentence. So I'll get back to that in a second, okay? So we have an association P to a polynomial, F sub P of X. This is by definition the characteristic polynomial of, let's say, frog P1, doesn't matter which one you choose, acting on the inertia invariance at P1. And this is just an element of C adjoin X. Okay, so we have an association, a prime to a polynomial. The degree of the polynomial is the same as the dimension of this. For all but finitely many primes, this is unramified. So for all but finitely many primes, this is a polynomial of degree equal to n, the dimension of V. And there are finitely many primes where the degree could be smaller. Okay, so quick aside. Why are the Frobenius elements lying over different primes all conjugate? And here's the reason. It's a calculation. I'll just say that they're conjugate, and the precise way in which they're conjugate is frog sigma p is equal to sigma frog p sigma inverse. And you just do a little calculation where you use the definition of frog p and the definition of frog sigma p, or a characterization of them in terms of what they do modulo p and modulo sigma p, and you get this. Okay, and it's written down in detail in proposition 10.4.1.
You use the transitivity of Galois. Right.
Yeah, use the let's see, are we using this?
Will that be?
Well, this tells us, yeah, okay, so first you have this relation, which means that if you knew that the Galois group acted transitively, then you know that all the Frobenii are conjugate. And yes, so yes. But just to prove this, you don't use anything about transitivity of the Galois group. Okay? All right, so this is amazing. What we've done is gone from a Galois representation to a systematic, using Frobenius elements, a systematic list of characteristic polynomials. And this is something you just couldn't do if you didn't have Frobenius elements. You could certainly go from take an element of the group and then give a characteristic polynomial. But tell me an element of Galois cube R over Q.
Trivial.
Okay. Two people will succeed, I think. Tell me another one.
Conjugation.
That's right, conjugation. Okay, you messed up my thing, so now I don't think anyone else will see. Any other ideas for elements of Galois cube R over Q that you can just think of? I can't think of any either. I mean, there's There's the trivial element, there's complex conjugation. And there really aren't, as far as I know, I've never sort of thought of any, I know of no way to kind of give another canonical element here. But it's really neat with Frobenius elements, if you have a finite Galois extension, here you do get canonical, at least at primes are unramified up to conjugation, you get a canonical element for each prime. So it's a nice way of systematically choosing elements of the Galois group. And it's also good because this is, there's a finite group here, but now you're getting one of these for every prime p. So you get this infinite list, and then you can put them together, you get an interesting analytic object. Okay, here's how. So we're almost, we can almost define this, the L function. So let's let R P of x be the polynomial you get by reversing the coefficients of FP of x. So by that, all I mean is, for example, x cubed plus 7, if fp x is x cubed plus 7x plus 3, then rp of x is 3x cubed plus
7x squared.
Yeah, 7x squared plus
1.
1, yes, thank you. Think of the as a list where you include the zeros and flip it around. So that's all I mean. And it is, I mean, you could equivalently do something by taking the Kerr poly of Frob inverse or something, but that's this is just one way of doing it. So this is the definition of RP, nothing deep there. And then now I can tell you what LP is. LP S is R, 1 over RP of P to the minus S. So that's the R and L function attached to a Galois representation. Yes?
You picked in a Frobenius element, but it could be like, you have like a lot of Frobenius elements, right? Like you can, there's more than one Frobenius element.
But they're all conjugate.
And
if you have two matrices and they're conjugate, then they have exactly the same characteristic polynomial. And the Frobenius elements are all conjugate. Remember, this is for a given prime. You fix a prime P in the integers, then there are g different pi up here,
right.
And for each one of these, there's a Frobenius element, and they're conjugate.
For each one of those, they're.
But those are all, those are conjugate to each. There's one for each one, and they're conjugate.
Is there one for each one? That's why I'm asking.
Well, that was the point of taking the inertia invariance here. So. Let's consider two cases. First, assume that P is unramified. There's no ramification here. Then the inertia groups are all trivial, and then there's exactly one Frobenius element for each PI, because you have an isomorphism between the Galois group of the extension of finite fields and the decomposition group. So you take a generator here, and it lists uniquely to an element here, because they're isomorphic. And that's the definition of the Frobenius element. It's, by definition, the lift of the generator, which is Pth powering, on the finite field.
So when you take the generator, you might be taking, like, there's more than one generator. There might be more than one.
Certainly more than one generator, but there's a canonical generator of the Galois group of a finite field, which is Pth powering. So if you take any finite field with characteristic P, you have an automorphism, which is x goes to x to the P.
So
and that generates, you can prove that generates the Galois group, because it has the right order to generate
the
Galois group.
Does it uniquely extend, though? Like,
yes. We prove that this map is surjective. Therefore, it extends.
I don't recall whether we proved that it doesn't, like,
so the inertia group, we proved that the order of the inertia group was the same as E, the ramification. That was not trivial. But at the end, on that side of the board, I proved that the cardinality of the inertia group, which is, the inertia group is by definition the kernel of reduction, the cardinality of the inertia group is equal to E for that prime. So E, well, it's a Galois extension, so just E. K over Q. So my hypothesis that P is unramified implies that the inertia group is trivial. This is an exact sequence. Therefore, these two groups are isomorphic. So if I have a way of choosing canonically an element of the Galois group of the extension of finite fields, I get a way of choosing canonically an element of the decomposition group. And that's what I call Frobenius. But I could have chosen a different prime line over P, and That would change from by conjugation as in the erased equation. Yes.
So the Carapali of two conjugate matrices are the same.
That's right.
But these are acting on different spaces, right?
Well, first, to I think I want to answer this question only in the case when the prime is unramified to avoid confusion. Then it's acting on the same space in both cases,
sure.
V. If the prime is ramified, then in one case you're acting on the inertia invariance for one I, and in another case you're acting on the inertia invariance for a different I.
Yeah.
Then it's more subtle. However, it's still true.
Okay.
But I'm not explaining that.
Okay?
But you can figure it out. Because you're very bright. Okay. Did I answer your question?
Just a question about the structure of the decomposition group. Is it
yes.
a cyclic group of order P?
If the inertia group is trivial, then the decomposition group is isomorphic to this group. This group is cyclic of order the degree of the extension, which the degree of this extension, well, its Galois group is isomorphic to a subgroup of GLN of C, so it could be quite large. It's some, I mean, you can imagine it's something like, I don't know, n to the n cubed or something, I don't know. But it could be smaller. Okay, other questions or comments? Okay, so that's it. I've now defined an L function. If you have a representation rho that is continuous, a Galois representation rho, then you get an L function where the local factors are the characteristic polynomials evaluated at p to the minus s after reversing the coefficients. So it seems like it's, just imagine it's a way of packaging up the arithmetic information that's encoded in the characteristic polynomials of Frobenius. That's what the L function does. Now there are some deep conjectures in the theorems about this. One is that is very much an open problem. So one is that the L function extends to a holomorphic function on C minus 0. I mean, sorry, minus 1. It's holomorphic, except possibly with the polar 1. And holomorphic, again, to say a little more about it, it means that in a neighborhood of each point, there's a power series with complex coefficients that converges to the value of the function. The function is locally analytic. And that's an incredibly strong constraint for a complex function. For a real function, it's not that strong of a constraint. But for a complex-valued function, which this is, it's an extremely strong constraint. But you have to take a course in maybe complex analysis to really appreciate how strong of a constraint being holomorphic is. Also, these are supposed to have... Well, so this is a conjecture. And it is known in some cases. For example, for one-dimensional representations, this is a theorem. So if here the n is 1, then that can be true, and it falls out of class field theory. So n equals 1, you're OK. If n equals 2, it's a major open problem. But there is some work towards it, actually a lot of fairly recent work. So there's... Remember, you were trying to guess a random element, or trying to tell me about some element of the Galois group of Q bar over Q, and the one non-trivial element you chose was complex conjugation.
So
yes.
With that, that's so. Like, I'm just wondering about that. So why couldn't we take any like usual any quadratic extension and take a map which takes one conjugate to the other and to any extension that doesn't contain whose polynomial isn't divisible by this? Thing should restrict to identity.
Okay.
I mean, that's the equivalent. I mean,
you haven't defined it on. But there are lots of fields that will contain your quadratic extension. How do you define the Galois? How do you make that automorphism act on those fields?
Define to be identity on those fields. The ones that are independent of your thing.
But what about the things that aren't independent of your thing? You need those two.
Yeah, for some reason, it'll probably be well defined.
You can make a well-defined thing, but you have to make choices.
Well, I mean,
you basically have to use the axiom of choice.
I mean, yeah, complex conjugation does the same thing, because in the step where you pick a preferred embedding of Q bar
mm-hmm.
into C.
Right. Well, I have to choose in order to define complex conjugation, you have to choose, you have to fix a Q bar. And my Q bar for this course I fix as a subfield of C. And then and only then do you even have complex conjugation. But I don't think you have anything else. I mean, it's true there are lots of other automorphisms in the Galois group, but how do you describe them? How do you say exactly what they are? You can say what they are in your quadratic field, and then you know that they extend. Any automorphism extends, but how do you say how it extends? There are lots of different ways to extend any automorphism. And you could say it's the identity on everything linearly disjoint from your field, but then on the stuff that isn't linearly disjoint,
whose square equals to your element, your so the fourth square of A, you have to define. That's a problem.
Q bar is countable, right?
So absolutely, yes.
It's not that bad.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to do like Galois.
Q bar is countable. Is Gal Q bar over Q countable? So what is Gal Q bar over Q, by the way? You can view it as the inverse limit of Gal K over Q, where you run over all finite Galois extensions. And if you know anything about inverse limits, it's very unlikely for an inverse limit to be countable. And in this case, it isn't.
But we just need to pick out one element of it, right?
Yep. And there are certainly many of them. I mean, there are infinitely many, and we can prove. You can prove there are. Every automorphism extends. The question isn't to prove that there are lots of others. It's just to describe it in some natural way, some canonical way. And if you fixed a choice, and you're right, it's necessary to fix a choice. If you fix a choice of embedding a Q bar into C, then after making that choice, there is a after in so canonical relative to making that choice. You have an element here which is complex conjugation. But I don't know any other element. If you make a different choice of embedding, that will change your complex conjugation into an element that's conjugate to complex conjugation. It's a confusing sentence, but it'll be something with the same characteristic polynomial, for example. So what we do, in any case, I'm just saying, I just want to remind you of that element. Let's call it C for complex conjugation. You can evaluate C. I mean, you can evaluate the representation at C, and you can get a very interesting invariant of the representation. Take the determinant of rho of complex conjugation. So here's a definition. Rho is odd if the determinant of rho of complex conjugation is equal to -1. And I'll just say if and only if. So it's a definition. The other possibility is that the determinant is +1, and then you say the rho is even. So maybe I should say even if the determinant of rho of complex conjugation is +1. So in the case when rho is odd, there's a generalization of Arbit's conjecture, which is that every two-dimensional representation, which is odd, should arise from a modular form. Should be modular. This is something very similar to what Wiles proved in the course of proving Provençal's theorem. He said that elliptic curves should come from modular forms. So there's a similar statement about odd Galois representations. They should come from modular forms. And I'll say more about modular forms in the future, but there is an approach to proving this conjecture in the case when A equals 2, which is to prove that rho is modular, and then once you know it's modular, this condition of holomorphicity follows easily. That's a very old theorem of Hecke, that things that are modular satisfy this holomorphicity condition. So let me summarize, though, what's known when, say, n equals 2. There's actually a general statement which doesn't rely on anything about n, I think. Well, actually, the general, well, I'm going to be careful because I'm not absolutely certain, but if the projected image of rho is solvable, so this is just a condition, but in general, if the projective image is solvable as a group, so if, by this I mean the following. You have a homomorphism, take its image, it's a subgroup of GLN of C, then GLN of C maps to PGLN of C, which is the quotient of GLN of C by the scalar matrices. You can take the image of rho here, you get a finite group, because after all it factors to this finite Galois extension. It's a group that's isomorphic to this Galois group. Then you can further take the image in PGLN of C. If that further image is solvable, in the case n equals 2, then Arden's conjecture is true. Then rho then Arden's conjecture is true for that representation. And this is a theorem of Langlands. It's a very deep theorem that I've not read the proof of, but it's one of the crucial ingredients to Weyl's proof of Fermat's last theorem. Knowing that when the objective image is solvable, then you have this analytic extension of, or holomorphic extension of your function. Actually, what they really prove is that the thing that's solvable and it comes from a modular form, and that gives this a little bit better. Now, since n equals 2, there's actually a classification of the subgroups of PGL2 of C, and there's only one that isn't solvable, and that's the icosahedral group, A5. So in the case n equals 2, only one, this theorem is actually really good because there's only one possible image that isn't solvable. So this takes care of everything. Except the projective image of rho being equal to the icosahedral group A5, order 60. So it's just index 2 subgroup of S5. Yes?
What kind of stuff follows if Arden's conjecture is true?
Well, let's see. From my point of view, it's more... The only way you can prove Arden's conjecture, at least for n greater than 1, so far no one's ever proved it in any cases, not by proving that the thing is modular. And knowing modularity of these representations is very useful. So one thing that falls from the slightly enhanced form of Arden's conjecture is from Fermat's last theorem. This was, again, a crucial ingredient to it. But... I don't really have like a laundry list of easy things. Like Riemann hypothesis implies everything under the sun. I don't have something that it's not so easy to see what you get from, at least to me, from Arden if you don't prove Arden by proving something better that implies Arden. But no one knows how to prove anything about Arden except by doing that. So if nothing else, it's an extremely good motivating problem because when you try to prove it, you end up proving more, and the more that you prove is really useful. If you've heard of the Langlands program, which people consider extremely important, this is, in some sense, a very special case of it. I think in isolation, it doesn't give you so much. It would certainly allow you to understand Galois representations better. Having holomorphicity gives, generally, just when you plug that into other things, you get better information about Galois representations. Okay, so that, so there's this one remaining case, which is the icosahedral case, and this, there's kind of a bit of a story here. So if you take n equals 2, take an odd representation, and assume its projective image is A5, so that's kind of the, that's the one situation where n equals 2 and rho is odd. That's the one situation where you don't know this conjecture. So we almost have the n equals 2 case in the case when the representation is odd. This is the one remaining part that we don't have. So the, there's you can look at a specific example. So you can take a specific Galois extension of Q that has Galois group A5, and I'm putting it over here, but really it's embedded in here, and then you can lift it to another group that has projective image A5 that sits inside of here, and then find explicitly an extension that in other words, you can explicitly write down, say, the first representation that's odd and has image A5. And Joe Hiller, who was a graduate student here in the 1970s, working with John Tate, did that. And then he wrote an entire thesis where the point of the thesis was to verify that this conjecture is true for that one example.
Wow.
Yeah, that was his whole thesis, was just checking one example of this conjecture. It was the first example ever of this conjecture. After that, there's a book, Springer Lecture Notes, 1585, and it verifies this conjecture for really the next 7 examples, or at least 7 more examples where their methods apply. And in each case, what they do is they work pretty hard to find a modular form. Again, I haven't told you what that means, but a modular form that gives rise to the representation and then prove it really does. And that's a lot of work, but it's possible. So so Bühler gave one example, then Gerhard Frey, who you might have heard from the Frey curve in context of Fermat's theorem, he and many other people, Ian Cumming and others, gave 7 more examples. And Frey, Frey et al., so he's the editor of the book. Bühler. And then Kevin Buzzard and I gave 7 more examples via a different method. So we proved that by huge computations and writing papers and stuff that there are 15 rho that satisfy this conjecture. And each, actually, given our methods, each time we proved that one rho satisfied the conjecture, it was automatic that any twists of rho would also satisfy the conjecture, where by twist I mean you tensor product this representation with an abelian representation. So it's just some simple transformation that really doesn't give you anything new. So really, there are 15 essentially different ones. And what Kevin Buzzard and I did was used a computer to do a bunch of computations, and we proved some things that allowed us to plug in or to use a theorem that Buzzard had proved with Richard Taylor. To verify Artin in 7 more examples. And that general theorem that Buzzard and Taylor proved, another grad student here, Mark Dickinson, well, Buzzard and Taylor realized that if you could refine what Weil's paper on Fermat's last theorem, but Weil has in many cases assumed P isn't 2 in various arguments. And they had realized that if you carefully did the arguments, but allowing the possibility that P equals 2, you could prove many, many cases of this conjecture. You could prove this statement for infinitely many rho that have of degree 2 that are odd and which have image A5. So Mark Dickinson, a couple of years ago here, did a PhD thesis in which he just very tediously went through what Weil did and verified that things work even when P equals 2. So that together, the three of them wrote a paper and they get infinitely many examples of rho that satisfy the conjecture. Their examples are completely disjoint from these 15, though. So they completely wreck my paper. But they don't get all of them. They just get infinitely many. And I think Richard's still working on trying to deal with all cases instead of just infinitely many. So if you're curious about one of the things Taylor spends his time thinking about, this is one of the questions. Proving Artin's conjecture for two-dimensional representations. Okay, that finishes chapter 10. And the next thing we're going to do is elliptic curves. So are there any questions about what I've said so far? Yes?
Another question, but I'm curious whether that's defined for real part of us greater than what that equation.
Oh, why is it defined for real part of us sufficiently large?
Is it defined for which domain does S have?
I think it depends on V.
I was just curious whether all L functions are defined for real S greater than 1.
I think it's, so that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question, unfortunately. Conjecturally, yeah. Right. That certainly falls from this conjecture. But I don't know if you can see that easily. I pretty much doubt it. By the way, I keep mentioning that the thing is meromorphic, and I'll just give you a 1 second description of how Artin proved this long ago. He proved that you could get any representation like this via various procedures using just n equals 1. So this L function is in fact the product of L functions of one-dimensional representations divided by another product of L functions of one-dimensional representations. And these the zeros of these are well enough understood that you know that you're not going to that you only have isolated zeros appearing in the bottom. So you get that the function is meromorphic. So I'm not telling you too much, but this doesn't say to me that you couldn't have this, you know, maybe, so the conjecture says that all the zeros in the bottom should cancel with zeros in the top, but it's not really clear. But this is a huge problem. It's very important. There's also some work in the case, but it's part of the, again, Langlet's problem, I should write that down. There's also, you can also consider rho even, and then so in the case when rho is odd, these are supposed to come from classical modular forms. Modular forms are holomorphic functions on the upper half plane that transform in a certain way under the action of a subgroup of SL2z. When rho is even, there are these things called Moss forms. I think that's how you spell it. And again, there's a conjecture that these representations should all arise, or these L functions of representations that are even should all arise from Moss forms. And there's less work towards that conjecture, but it is another area of active research. For example, yesterday in the mail, I randomly received a thesis which was about computing with Moss forms, and I would be surprised if the person who wrote the thesis had as an application in mind something about this conjecture. It's a big motivating conjecture. And what I'm going to do next is, I'll just summarize. Oh, yes, please.
What's the Langlet's program?
It's a huge overarching program that says that L functions that you construct in one way should be constructible in another way. You've heard the statement, every elliptic curve over Q is modular. In some vague sense, this is the ultimate generalization of that statement. It says exactly what modular should mean in general and what should be modular. And if you asked me to make a very precise description of what the Langlet's program says, I couldn't do it, because it's really big. I've been to conferences on the program, I still don't understand exactly what it claims. But it's a huge number of conjectures. It's very representation theoretic in its statements and so on. You could do a project on it, though, if you want, then I could find out exactly what it says. Next one I'm going to do is tell you what an elliptic curve is. I'll define them. I'll talk about the group law for a few minutes. And you can see that in the notes. And then I'm going to define L functions attached to elliptic curves. And really, there'll be two motivating goals for the remaining month of the course. One is to define L functions attached to elliptic curves and state the Bergson-Swinnerton-Dyer conjecture, which is really the kind of the big central problem in some area of number theory, at least. And there's an analog of this statement for L functions attached to elliptic curves over Q, and it's a theorem of Weyl's, Bray, Conrad, Diamond, and Taylor. So I'll mention that.
And second, I want to tell you a little bit about just the basic arithmetic of elliptic curves. So I'll sketch a proof of the Mordell-Weil theorem, which says that Mordell Weil groups of elliptic curves over Q, or even over number fields, are finitely generated. This will be an application of finiteness of the class group and an analog of the unit theorem that we proved, and of Galois cohomology. So I'll give you an introduction also to Galois cohomology.
So elliptic curves, L functions attached to elliptic curves, Galois cohomology, and that is all coming up shortly. Okay, so thanks. If you have any questions, just let me know.
Did you get 9 or 12?
What's that?
Did you get 9 or 12 on a pizza?
I didn't get 12, I guess. I
guess.
Okay. I think the first half of the conversation, I already didn't get 12, but I can't finish it.
Well,
we'll
do that.
Is
that generally
so
the pattern?
Yeah, I know.
I don't have notes for that. I can probably give you like some.
Were there any really good
things? Maybe as Dizzy needs solutions, he had all the interesting ones.
There are two backup plans, so.
Actually,
we're not
going to. Are you talking about his Venomon maybe?
But it'll take a little while to develop.
I mean, there was that.
Or strategy for the two.
So if you look at proof three,
so,
this is proving the.
Set these running so much longer.
Yeah, so this is the. I forget the name of it. They donated their n to the n minus 2, which spanning trees on a complete graph.
How about just make it arbitrary?
So if you look at the proof of this, you basically follow the same idea as
some of them should take 12 days each.
Oh, really?
Like the case of.
Get any more, it'll be nice.
Thank you, Postacol.
At least something running well, right? Try to develop a better strategy.
Okay.
I mean, we could say the same thing about this class.
Oh, should I? Okay, I'll just go see.
Yeah.
What
24 hours.
Okay.
Yeah,
but notes for this class.
Put 24 hours.
So there are notes on.
That's
true. There's no notes for testing
yeah.
for the combinatorics class.
That would do.
How many problems are there?
We'll see if any more get
today.
I would just say arbitrary and run it for a few and see if it's any at all.
And
our expectation would be that we're going to finish these using
the
different method.
The original paper was written in the 70s, and we don't have access to the
online
archives
of
the right
journal.
We don't have access to the archives
going
back
for example, my office hours,
Tuesday
and Thursday,
and
if you can meet me in 3.5 hours.
This was his,
if it doesn't work,
I don't know.
Email and
yeah.
This is like his.
You can never come at Tuesdays and Thursdays.
I have no idea.
I don't know, maybe.
You can make an appointment for
I mean, I'm sure that there are books that discuss material somewhere, but like when I was doing this last night, I didn't really. Actually, I did that class. It's a fun class. I, like, the problem set.
Well,
I mean,
oh, yeah.
sometimes I feel like.
Yeah,